Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is the New Books Network. I'm Jim Cates. Terry Finneman is an associate professor of journalism at the University of Kansas in Lawrence. She's a journalism historian who also studies local news, and she is the founder of the Journalism History Podcast. She is the author of Reviving Rural News, Transforming the Business Model of Community Journalism in the U.S. and Beyond. Her co-authors on that project are Nick Matthews at the School of Journalism at the University of Missouri and Patrick Ferrucci, who is associate professor and chair at the Department of Journalism at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Terry Finneman, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
We hear a term lately, just to get started here, we hear a term lately of the news desert. And these are places that are proliferating in the United States and certainly in rural areas that you are writing about here. What exactly is a news desert? Why is the number of news deserts increasing? And why is this a problem for civic participation and ultimately for American democracy?
Oh my, yeah, we could talk for like 2 hours just about that, just about those questions. You know, there are different definitions of news deserts. I tend to not get into the, you know, weeds on that because I'm interested in solving problems, not creating encyclopedia definitions. But I mean, in general, of course, a news desert is an area that is lacking in local news. And, you know, I think more broadly, it's considered like an entire community that doesn't have a newspaper or any local news source. But it has also been examined from the perspective that, you know, Boston, for example, has many news outlets, right? So on its face, it may not be considered a news desert, but there are also populations, demographics within that larger city that are not being covered in the news and, you know, also are considered news deserts. And so publications are popping up to serve those populations. So essentially, it's considered populations that are not served with news. Now, this has become more of a problem in the last, I don't know, you know, 15 years or so. I mean, you know, we saw it with classifieds first really taking the hit and losing those to the internet. And then, of course, seeing social media. But you're also seeing more newspapers that have been bought up by Wall Street corporations that don't care at all about local news. They only care about money. They don't give a crap about your community. And so therefore, more and more journalists, tens of thousands of journalists have been laid off. And so we have fewer people to cover news, which creates a lot of the problems that we're seeing today, because I really see local news as providing social cohesion to a community, right? Like within a community, you have all these different pockets of people who are into their own thing. But a newspaper is kind of the central place that serves the whole town and brings all of those different populations into one place to make them feel centered in a community. I mean, it's why historically, when people came out west, you know, the first things to be set up were a bar and a newspaper, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, because a newspaper was considered just a central component of communication and social cohesion for a community. And by not having as many reporters, by communities losing their newspapers, you're seeing that kind of shredding of cohesion, of democracy, of being informed.
Yeah, and it's interesting you're looking at this particularly from a historical perspective. I'm trained in history myself. I would agree that you know, we're seeing maybe a worry about this that almost harks back to the Jacksonian era, when it was thought that the function of newspapers was to knit together the states, the very disparate states in the brand new United States. So this idea that the, you know, what did someone from Massachusetts have in common with someone from Kentucky? And soon enough, we saw newspapers that were distributed nationally and through the mail. And then so building community nationally, locally. People such as Alexis de Tocqueville wrote about this. Imagined communities is the term often used. And so this is coming to the fore again. I did want to clarify the setting for your study, because when I started out reading this, it did occur to me that your setting is quite different, even from where I live in southern Wisconsin. You're looking at proprietors of independent weekly newspapers in the Great Plains, the Dakotas, Nebraska, and Kansas. This is real rural journalism practiced by newspapers that may have been around a century or more. So they're quite unusual.
Yeah, I mean, this is going back to historically, right, when newspapers were locally owned. You know, there's no way we could work with newspapers with this project that were part of a corporation. I mean, there's just too much red tape and it just wouldn't work, right? Yeah, and so we're working with more of these family-owned newspapers, which are doing much better because they're not tied to a corporation and they can make local decisions that are best for their community.
You surveyed a lot of publishers in Nebraska, Kansas, North and South Dakota, in small communities. You found, I wouldn't necessarily call it resistance to change, but skepticism about change, skepticism about whether this was really necessary, and can't we, continue chugging along for this for a while? Can you tell me a little bit about those findings?
Yeah, it was really interesting. So we did the survey and we gave publishers, I don't know, I think it was like 14 or 15 options. Like, what kind of revenue sources would you be open to, as my co-authors and I were trying to think of a business model to create? And it was very striking, perhaps not surprising, that when we got the results, they were adamant about keeping the business model they currently have, which is the advertising, the legal notices, and the print subscriptions. And there was really no openness to considering any of the other ones. And so we started with the publisher surveys to give us some grounding of what they thought. And then I'm sure we'll get to this. Then we went to the reader surveys and asked readers what they thought. And then we came back to the publishers to talk about, well, this is what the readers said, and got their opinions on it. And then, yeah, it had some continued resistance, uncertainty regarding that. And I mean, you can't really blame them. I mean, you mentioned Andrew Jackson earlier, and I mean, the business model that we're using today was developed, really started during the Andrew Jackson era. The penny press was invented in 1833, for the love of God, right? Which was this concept that news should be cheap. Before then, news had been expensive. So this concept that news should be open to the masses and be cheap is something that continues to the present. I mean, think about it. 1833, one penny, and 2024, there are a lot of weeklies out there that are selling their product for 75 cents or a dollar. Mm-hmm. We have gone up 99 cents in 200 years. Tell me any other product. I mean, Tootsie Rolls have probably had greater inflation. You know what I'm saying? When you go to the checkout counter, you can't get a pop or a candy bar anymore for less than $2. And we're selling news for virtually nothing. And this business model is simply not working anymore.
As you went and put together a number of, I would compliment you on this, very, very ambitious research projects, you zeroed in on Newton, Kansas, which is a small community. It was about 30 miles north of Wichita. And so this is a very rural area, just far out enough from Wichita. This is really not part of the Wichita economic orbit. You found a couple of, unusual people there who were very willing to work with you. And you said, you know, let's put together a project. And what you eventually came up with, which you describe at some length in your book, is the press club model. It's, I wouldn't call it a radical departure from traditional publishing. It at its core, it's still ink on paper. But this is a framework for small newspapers. In this case, you're dealing with a weekly, to become more engaged with their communities. Things such as, well, some of these revenue-generating things you ask publishers about, community events, a higher tier of what we might call membership. We're sort of kind of borrowing elements here from public radio or big sites like the Texas Tribune or a MinnPost in Minnesota, where you can become a a member, get it, sort of an insider thing, be in the know. So socials for these people at the higher tier of membership, and then possibly supplementing that print publication with an online newsletter a couple or three, four times a week to keep people tied in. At least in Newton, they're having some, I would say, fairly good success with this. No one is getting rich, but can you tell me about the experience in Newton, the press club model?
Yeah, so the model that we ended up coming up with was heavily based on what readers told us. Mm-hmm. So we hired a professional survey company, Coda Ventures, to do the survey for us because I don't have enough time to track down, 70-year-old men in South Dakota who will take a survey, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so we ended up having 400 readers, and they were all from rural areas. We specifically left out, Fargo, Sioux Falls, Lincoln, Wichita, those kinds of towns. We just wanted to hear from rural readers about what they thought. And we heard from 400 of them. And they told us they were given the same options as the publishers to pick from. And they by far chose events, print subscriptions, e-newsletters, memberships, and donations were how they were willing to support newspapers. And it was very interesting because, of course, there's the overlap with print subscriptions, but there was otherwise no overlap with what the publishers had said in their business model. So you're seeing a disconnect between what publishers think revenue should be and what the readers are willing to pay for. And that's a big part of the problem, right? Mm. And so we ended up, as I mentioned before, taking the reader feedback to publisher focus groups and asking them what they thought. And we very adamantly heard from publishers they were not open to accepting donations. Absolutely mm-hmm. not. And they were so adamant against it that my team and I had no choice but to leave it off. Even though mm-hmm. it's like, you know what, you got people who are willing to give you free money and you don't mm-hmm. want it. Okay. But we didn't want to create a model that nobody was willing to do. That would defeat the point.
Yeah, so- I remember I noted specifically the comment from one publisher. He said, I wouldn't ask people for donations any more than I would be, open to going down to my insurance man and giving him a donation or him giving me a donation. He says, we're business people. We are kind of pulling our own weight. So there's a little bit of, this is one way in which we're not going to duplicate the NPR model.
Yeah. And, that was interesting to me because, I come from the traditional media background, obviously, but right now I also run my own News Desert newspaper. I'm the publisher mm-hmm. of a paper I created, mm-hmm. and we are primarily 100% donation funded. And so I have moved to that model and I have had no qualms about it. Mm-hmm. Quite frankly, it's worked okay for us. But yeah, there's just, that strong sense of capitalism and tying objectivity to capitalism, it's just too entrenched for us to mm-hmm. deal with that right now. So we ended up focusing heavily on the events, e-newsletters, and memberships when we approached Joey Young, the publisher of the Newton newspaper that we worked with, Harvey County Now, and he was on board with it. And his team put in a lot of work. They were the ones who came up with the idea to call this concept Press Club. They actually had not heard or known that a National Press Club existed before. They came up, and I let the National Press Club know that this exists. But So they came up with this concept, which was a really great one. And we, for a year, tested out this model. The news team at first, there was some skepticism, right? This is going to be a lot of work. I don't have time to do this. I don't really know. And so over the course of the year, they, of course, had to stick with it because they had a contract with us. So there were some ebbs and flows, which is perfectly normal. But by the time we got to the end of the experiment, I think everybody on the team came to realize, this didn't take all that more work. We mostly had to just shift our mindset and how we were going about doing things. And that this model ultimately proved very successful for them, not just from a financial standpoint, but also feeling much more connected with their community than before they started the experiment.
You mentioned this event they held called Blues, Brews, and Barbecues, this annual sort of big community picnic with the sponsorship by the paper, and although it actually turned out to be a money-making event, and how they would essentially meet people they had never met before, even within this fairly small community, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, and they actually started that before the experiment with us.
Okay.
You know, they saw that that event was successful, which is what made them more open to the idea of, you know what, we should do some other events. And they don't always have to be huge. Like, for example, those who are members of Press Club, you know, they're invited to sign up for baseball tickets to, you know, come out and let's go to a game together and create some, again, sense of community, which has especially been lacking after COVID. You know, let's go tour a brewery together, right? And so they're creating smaller events that are already with people they have connections to. And it, going back to that old-fashioned historical concept that a newspaper should be a community gathering social cohesion place, and doing this not just in print, but also in person.
You know, we think of newspaper audiences demographically as old. Old and fairly affluent, politically active in their communities. This is a subset of the community. It looked to me at points as if some of these events were helping to broaden the demographic, particularly maybe to bring in some younger readers, some younger community members.
Yes, absolutely. That was the goal. Their model has really focused heavily on Gen X and millennials. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, it was interesting when we were doing these surveys and talking to readers, we asked them, you know, how likely would you be to financially support your newspaper if you knew it was in trouble? And yeah, there is this myth out there that it is the baby boomers who are like holding up the news industry. And we found that the boomers were least likely to pay if they knew their newspaper was in trouble. Like Gen Z was more likely to support the newspaper than the boomers were. Okay. And so I think breaking past these mythologies is what, you know, the industry really has to do. We actually found that the dad demographic, like men between 35 and 50, were the most likely to step up if they knew their newspaper needed help. So we've got to shift our narrative. Then that's not to say, of course, to ignore the baby boomers. Of course, I'm not saying that. But we have to stop acting like they are the only audience to cater to. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of people in the younger demographics who are willing to be engaged if we give them the opportunity.
And the people in Newton, at least at one point, they were competing directly with Gatehouse Media. Is that correct?
Yeah, they still have a competitor, yes.
That is a very ambitious thing to do in a small community. My hat's off to them. That is really something. Because they have not been around that long, right?
No, they haven't. And, you know, that's why I decided to ask Joey if he would partner with us on this. I didn't know Joey very well. I had just seen him in passing at different newspaper events. And he struck me as somebody who was very different. Somebody who was very open, who was willing to try new things. Yeah. And so when I actually called him up, because I had to apply for grant money to do this, I said, Joey, I have absolutely no idea what I'm going to ask you to do, but I need you to tell me right now, are you in or are you out? And without hesitation, he was in. That's the kind of partner we needed. And very, very few people would have said that.
That brings me to my next question. How do we get people with an entrepreneurial temperament to take risks like this? And in a weekly newspaper environment in the Great Plains, the payoff is unlikely to be huge. This is not like going to work for Google, but we still need someone with a lot of energy, a lot of ideas, and that classic entrepreneurial mindset of plowing through even when other people may have doubts about what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, that is most certainly the biggest challenge. I mean, certainly a big part of it needs to be journalism schools changing their framing. For a long time, journalism schools have focused on, you know, the big paper, you know, the Washington Post, the New York Times. That's when you've really made it, right? And so when we bring in guest speakers from these big places, I mean, that tells students, this is what journalism is, this is what's important, right? And so we need to be introducing students more to community journalism, bringing weekly newspaper editors into our classrooms, telling students that there are opportunities there, because how are they going to know otherwise? And journalism schools have not historically been doing a good enough job doing that. Now, on the other side of the coin, though, the challenge for Generation Z is that they do not always feel comfortable in these rural communities. Generation Z is very diverse. You have members of the gay community, you have members who are racially diverse, who do not feel like they are welcome in rural communities, which is why they tend to gravitate more to the cities. And so it's also a societal issue, as well as introducing them to the business prospects issue.
You, I know at least one of your publishing partners has done work in the nonprofit model, what I sometimes call the pro-am model, where a local community, give you an example here in my, where I live in southern Wisconsin, we have a media company that shall go unnamed that buys struggling newspapers and bleeds them dry. And turns them into, these are small dailies, most of them, turns them into what you're probably familiar with the term ghost newspapers.
Right.
Which is to say a newspaper that may have one reporter. In our case, it's a 7,000 circulation daily with one reporter who spends, frankly, I think most of her time laying out the paper and dumping press releases into it. It's basically a glorified shopper. So we get sites like that, and then as alternatives to them, for example, in my community, we have an alternative news site that is gutsy enough to proclaim itself on its news site as your local community newspaper. They use the word newspaper, even though they are online only. So this is an online brand. It's run by a former newspaper person. Contributors include the managing editor of the newspaper, the local newspaper, back when it was a very good local newspaper. Or can a venue that makes money be online only? They tend to be run either by volunteers or by journalism veterans who are probably relying on their Social Security checks to get by. Now, do you see this as... at least your model, is it definitely ink on paper? Can it be online only?
Oh, I think it certainly can, absolutely. And I mean, Joey and his team saw tremendous success with the e-newsletter, and they're very glad that they have moved to that. Because, I mean, you're seeing the post office, which is a total wreck, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the post office has just been horrible to the newspaper industry forever,
yes.
But now it's especially bad, right? So Joey's team has been really glad to get in, not necessarily early, but I mean, to start to shift to this e-newsletter thing so that they feel better prepared, that if they do have to make the decision to go online only, that their readers are more accustomed to it. Now, they did a survey of their readers who still very much support print, so they're not looking at giving that up quite yet, as long as the revenue is not there. But it's putting the pieces in place so that if legals go away, if the postal service becomes untenable, that there is a plan in place to shift to go online.
Yeah, I did. I was quite struck by that issue. I believe it was the one they put out in Newton, showing that, and Newton is a good looking newspaper. It's got a nice design. You can tell the people behind it, they know what they're doing. But they did put out this front page article showing that to physically produce each copy of that weekly newspaper cost about $3, which is stunning, incredibly expensive.
Yeah, I mean, in the newspaper industry, we have got to be more transparent, right? I mean, we've got to stop the, you know, we're dying, you know, tears, and actually mm-hmm. give people real information and explain and be upfront, right? We expect everybody else to be upfront, but we don't do it ourselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my own newspaper, I'm constantly writing columns telling people about our financial state, right? This is where we're at. This is what we need from you. I mean, why not, right?
Yeah.
And so I really, you know, Joey and his team were quite nervous about running that story, which, I mean, is understandable, but they got tremendous reaction. I mean, of course, you're going to have the 3% who are trolls and, you know, no matter what you do, you're going to have that. But I mean, what they have found after they ran that piece, after the year-long experiment that they had with us, where they tried new things, where they increased relationships with their community, they felt comfortable running that piece and telling their community, we are doubling the price of your subscription, and everybody is now going to be a Press Club member as a result. And the first time that I checked in with them, they had retained at least 90% of their readership. So you now have 90% of people paying twice as much as before, with very little backlash and much understanding after simply being transparent and building the relationships.
Yeah, that says a lot for transparency. I think, for example, of a membership organization I'm part of that it just recently said, well, we're going to double your dues, and the publication we put out, which is a very good magazine, is going online only. And if you want, if you still want to get it in print, you've got to pay double the dues plus $25 a year to get the magazine on paper. And there was a really bad backlash on that. So I can see where transparency is probably the only alternative in many senses.
Well, I mean, we have to. I mean, you know, you talk about backlash and, you know, the little bit that Joey got, and it's absolutely ridiculous, okay? I mean, when I'm going around giving public talks, I'm like, if your weekly newspaper costs $1, that means you're paying 14 cents a day for local news. Mm-hmm. Would your business stay in business if you were charging 14 cents for your services? I mean, it's insanity. It is absolute insanity. And we need to frame it to people as that. Does your plumber accept 14 cents when they come over to fix your toilet? Not really. I mean, we have let this get out of control for like 100 years longer than we should have. You know what I'm saying? With how cheap, as I said earlier, you can't even get a candy bar at the checkout counter for less than $2 nowadays, yeah. Right? And yet we're charging 75 cents or a dollar for news.
This in a time when people are paying $60, $70, $80 a month for multiple streaming channels on cable.
Exactly. They have no doubt problem spending $20 at Starbucks every morning.
Yes,
but
that
you ask
too.
Them to pay a dollar to buy an article online and you get paywall and then they melt down. Like, there has got to be more public education, especially with concern about misinformation, disinformation, actual fake news. There needs to be a public education campaign that if you are paying for news, you can feel confident that it is probably real. If it's free, you're getting what you pay for.
Mm-hmm. Now, at Kansas, you've got, not to heap any more responsibility on you, but Kansas is a very good journalism school. It's very widely known. You're in a rural area, and you're in the Great Plains, which are depopulating, and we worry about issues in the Great Plains, you know, like the aging of the population, the crumbling of local institutions. Kansas is a local place for, is a logical place for outreach. Every place is a logical place for outreach, but especially if you've got a good journalism school, and I know because I've worked with them, I know you've got some good students at Kansas. And in places like yours, we see teachers and faculty stepping into the breach to help provide local journalism in and near their communities. What sometimes is called the teaching hospital model of journalism education, have the students go right along with the pro. In that vein, tell us about the Eudora Times, which is your big project right now. Is that right?
Yeah, I started the Eudora Times 5 years ago, and I now help run kind of a consortium called News Desert U, where I work with other faculty around the country who are also interested, or already do, run local news outlets with students to help solve a news desert crisis in their area. And so when I moved to Kansas, I somehow found out that Eudora, this community of 6,500 people didn't have a newspaper. And I was absolutely shocked because to me, that's a big town. I'm from a rural area in North Dakota. That's what my accent is for people who are listening. Okay. So I'm from a town of 2,500 people in Western North Dakota. So I couldn't, and I'm a problem solver. That's what I'm all about. I'm not about just talking. I'm about actually doing things. And so we started very small. We started just doing social media posts, taking pictures around the community. But then it's like, well, you know, there's stories to be done. And so then we created a website and we have just slowly grown in the last 5 years, building up capacity. I now have a team of, I think, six students. I have a full-time editor. She graduated from college last year after being part of us as a student. And she's with us with grant funding right now. So we have our first full-time person. But yeah, I mean, students are the sports editor and the advertising director. And it's gone very, very well.
And this is published. Well, being on the web, is there a quote unquote publication day, or is it more or less updated as news pops up? How does that work?
Yeah, we run as kind of a small daily. We try to run 9 pieces of content a week to try to have something fresh at least every day. We also do community events. As the day that we're filming this, we're actually having a pie tasting contest tonight.
Sounds good. Okay.
Yeah, you know, we do holiday cookie contests. We do readers board. We're active with the Senior Citizen Center. We do put out at least 1 print publication a semester. We created a new residence guide magazine last semester. We're doing a senior citizen magazine this semester. So we do a little print, but we do primarily operate online.
You cover, I assume, as well, the things that often do not get covered these days, like city council, the school board, government coverage.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge part of what we do, obviously. But when you say things that don't get covered, I mean, we go deeper than that. Like, mm-hmm. we are really proud of our senior citizen reporting. Mm-hmm. We are really proud of our youth reporting. We're very different, you know, not only in our business model being donation funded, but we operate very differently than the mainstream papers that I came from, in that we are a very bottom up, not a top down. And by bottom up, we are constantly engaging with our community and asking them what they care about and what they want to see covered, and really leaning into that as opposed to, you know, this is what we think you should care about, so care about it, right? We try to very much partner with our community. And so we cover a lot of things that would not be considered newsworthy by other newspapers, but because it's important to our community, we go. So for example, yesterday we went to State Band and Choir. Tell me how many other newspapers show up at State Band and Choir just as they do state basketball, right?
Yeah.
That's important to our community, so we went.
Absolutely. I read the piece you ran a while back about the girl who was a violinist. I'm a musician myself. So there's always going to be something that catches people's attention. And of course, in Eudora, it's also going to be high school sports.
Yeah, absolutely. My last sports editor, he was there for 1.5 years, and he was so beloved by the community. I mean, it was unbelievable. Like, they always looked for Jack on the sideline. They just absolutely loved him. And I'm really, really glad that I now have a new sports editor who's doing a great job helping build that. Because, yeah, I mean, the sense of trust that builds just from Jack going to a soccer game, right, is there's no words to put in play with that.
Do you run advertising in the Eudora Times, or is it donation only? And how does that model work for actually raising enough money to keep yourself going?
Yeah, I mean, well, one of the benefits of our publication is that, you know, we don't really print very often. We're online only, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's free. I'm obviously getting paid my professor's salary, so all of the publishing duties that I'm doing are essentially for free, but I already have a job, so I'm okay, right? And so any money that comes in goes to the students. It's sort of like scholarships, basically, to help support them for their work. So we are primarily donation funding, both from people in Eudora as well as journalism school alumni. But we have in the last year branched into more advertising opportunities, especially with some of the print publications like the graduation tab that we do.
Oh, yes.
You know, one of the challenges for Eudora, like other small communities, is that the business space is very quite small, right? Which is why the advertising model that we have had since the late 1800s, right, isn't really working anymore. And so we talk a lot about how we need readers to step up, right? If you want us at the state basketball tournament, you need to chip in and do your part.
Yeah. Again, looking back at journalism history, I studied rural newspapers around the time of, about 1900. And to them, the biggest threat in the world was the Sears catalog.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, people reacted to the Sears catalog the way a lot of people react to Amazon today. It's going to destroy our little local businesses. And catalog shopping was regarded as, well, I had one publisher who put it almost in moral terms. He said, it's a sin. It's a sin to order something from a catalog when you could buy it from, you know, the local harness maker or the local dry goods person. But now, well, I guess we got a lot of sinners out there because they're doing it. And Eudora, of course, is maybe just close enough to be a bedroom community for Kansas City.
Right.
And that's a problem, too, with your base. So I think, you know, to conclude, the logical takeaway here is that if we're going to see any widespread revival of rural news, it's going to be a mix of things. The model you're looking at is for profit for small independent entrepreneurs, along with these nonprofit community websites, these pro-am sites. You know, maybe there's one person with professional background in the mix, maybe a part-time webmaster. And then to round out this three-legged model, efforts by journalism schools. And I'm wondering, looking ahead, if you can offer any predictions as to how this whole news ecosystem in rural communities might evolve over the next 10 or 20 years.
Oh, I always find predictions to be dangerous questions.
Oh, yes, very.
I actually avoid them at all costs because I find that people make predictions about elections or whatever are almost always wrong.
Yeah.
But I mean, to not totally punt, I guess, on your question, I mean, I am very committed in the near future to, I'm going to be working on a book this fall called News Desert U, where I'm going to be visiting with universities across the country who are serving local communities with students and providing them news to create case studies, to build models. So this book can be used by other schools to think about, okay, how can I do my part and help with this issue? And so in the short term, I am looking at building up universities. As far as the experiment that I did with Harvey County Now and small local newspapers, I'm going to be speaking at the Nebraska Press Association, and it's just taking that time to work with weekly publishers and help them adapt and letting them know that this is also about the future. If you are going to want to try to sell your newspaper and try to attract a younger person to taking it over, you're going to want to consider modernizing more to make it more appealing.
Terry Finneman, thank you so much for joining us today. You know, I was thinking it's nice for you in your research efforts. I assume you do a lot of presentations at conferences and such, incorporating the historical element and also pulling in this modernizing of the journalism community, the business model in changing times. So you're doing scholarship, and at the same time, you're sort of an evangelist for positive change in a sphere that definitely needs a lot of it.
Thank you. Yes, that is exactly what I'm trying to do. We have to understand the history of where we came from, why we're doing the things that we're doing, the fact that it's 200 years old. I think a lot of people don't really think about that. That what we're doing today, not only from the business side, but also how we define news. So the definition of what's newsworthy was also formed in the late 1800s and also needs to be revised, in my opinion. That's the next step, right? So I'm trying to, and I put, you know, Andrew Jackson's face big on a PowerPoint screen to try to drive in, this is why things aren't working. This is why we need to think about something different.
Terry Finneman is the author of Reviving Rural News, Transforming the Business Model of Community Journalism in the U.S. and Beyond. Her co-authors are Nick Matthews and Patrick Ferrucci. The book is published by Routledge. And Terry Finneman, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
This is the New Books Network. I'm Jim Cates.